If you want to be more creative in your work, you probably don't need to try harder. You need to try something different. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. In his new book, Imagine, How Creativity Works, Jonah Lehrer deconstructs imagination and gives us all tools we can use to be more creative. I'll talk with him about what he learned from studying the techniques of some of the most creative people in the world, what science tells us about creativity, and how all of us can use this information to ignite a creative spark. Later in the hour, I'll talk with Jay Swords and Brett Mennard, two teachers who are taking students to Destination Imagination. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Creativity seems to come easily to children, but as we grow and learn and focus, many of us seem to lose our creative spark. But we don't have to. Later this hour, I'll talk with two Iowa teachers who are working to help their students harness creative energy. But first, Jonah Lehrer is with me. He is the author of Imagine, How Creativity Works. Hello, Jonah.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on the show.
Well, thank you for being here today. And a lot of the people that you write about, Bob Dylan, Yo-Yo Ma, William Shakespeare, these are creative geniuses, and most of us don't believe or imagine that there's any way we could ever think or create like they do or they did. What gave you the idea of studying people like this to try to break down the creative process?
Well, it was because I think too many of us don't think we're creative. There are these very sad surveys of school kids where you ask a second grader, are you creative? And 95% of second graders say, yes, I'm creative. I love to paint. I love to draw. I love to sculpt and so on. You ask fifth graders, and you're down to about 50% who think they're creative. By the time you get to high school seniors, upwards of 90% say they are not creative. They're not a creative type. And that's totally wrong. The science comes with a very optimistic message. The science shows us that creativity is a universal trait of human nature. It doesn't mean we're all equally good at it, but it does mean we can all learn to get better at it.
So why look at people that we consider to be geniuses? You also studied the science of creativity as well, but why start with, let's say, Bob Dylan?
Well, I mean, I don't just talk about geniuses in the book, but you know, I think we can learn a lot from how these creative geniuses do it. I think, in a sense, one of the things that separates geniuses from the rest of us is that intuitively, I think they have a better understanding of how the imagination works. I think one of the long-standing myths about creativity is that creative thinking is a single thing, that there's one way we should always be thinking when we want to create something new. And what the science reveals is that creativity is actually a catch-all term for a variety of distinct thought processes, each of which is useful at different parts of the creative process. So I think what you see with these creative geniuses is that intuitively, they've come to understand how their mind works, and so they're better able to think in the right way at the right time. That's a lesson I think the rest of us can learn from.
Well, I think this example of Bob Dylan is really interesting because he was already writing music. He was already very popular. He was already world famous and traveling around the world, and he became very frustrated creatively, and he quit. And that's what led to his big breakthrough.
Yeah, so this is a story that takes place in the early summer of 1965. Dylan is a folk star. He just finished this whirligig tour. And in London, after the last shows in London, he tells his manager that he is done with the music business. He is quitting singing and songwriting. He's going to move to a small cabin in Woodstock, New York, and going to paint and write novels. He doesn't even bring his guitar. He's there for a couple days when he feels, as he puts it, the itch of unwritten words, grabs a pencil and a pad of paper, and he starts to scribble. Once he begins writing, his hand doesn't stop moving for the next several hours. He later describes it as he feels as if he's just vomiting forth these words, that he's got no control over what he's writing down. And when he looks back over these 25 pages of scribbles, what he discovers are the lyrics to Like a Rolling Stone. And he sees this chorus, and then he knows this is it. This is the song he was meant to write. The very next week, he brings these lyrics into the cramped space of Studio A at Columbia Records in New York City. And on the fourth take, they record Like a Rolling Stone. And the lesson for there, I think, I use that to talk about the neuroscience behind moments of insight, you know, those epiphanies that arrive when we least expect them in the shower, when we're on a walk. Because one of the, one of the interesting features of these moments of insight is that they often arrive after we've, in a sense, embraced the rut, embraced the fact that we are stuck and stumped. And so instead of chaining ourselves to our desk, forcing ourselves to make progress, we move to Woodstock, we go for a walk, we take a bubble bath. And that's often when our best ideas arrive, after we stop searching for them.
So many of us spend every day, every working day, at least struggling to focus. We drink the coffee in the morning, we sit at the desk, and we try to do whatever we can to keep on task. And from what you've written and what you've learned from researchers all over the world, it sounds like we're all doing it wrong.
Well, if you need a moment of insight, obviously focus is often essential, and there are many parts of the creative process that don't require moments of insight. A moment of insight is one of these big epiphanies. But when you need a big breakthrough, when you feel like your problem's impossible, you're going to be really frustrated. You're going to feel stuck. But that's your brain telling you you need a moment of insight now. And what the research shows is that people are much more likely to have moments of insight when they're in a relaxed state of mind. So it's not an accident that we have so many good ideas in the shower, right? Because we can't check our email. It's relaxing being pelted by warm water. We're just shampooing our hair. And that's when finally, at long last, we hear that quiet voice coming from the back of the head trying to give us the answer. Maybe that voice has been there for hours or days or weeks. We just haven't taken a moment to listen. There's this wonderful line of Einstein's that creativity is the residue of wasted time. And I think, to summarize the science, when you need a moment of insight, it's very important to make time to waste time.
So can you engineer a moment of insight, even if it's something small, like you're working on something that you're writing and you just need a new idea, a new way to say something? Can you engineer this moment?
You can't engineer it. I mean, there is no money-back guarantee, but you can make yourself much more likely to have one. And I think that's why it's so important to learn how to get relaxed. I think we do live, as you point out, in a day and age which assumes the only way to be productive is to focus, 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 to chug that triple espresso and chain yourself to your desk and stay up late. And sometimes it's necessary, but sometimes that's just the wrong approach. So then we have to be more confident that sometimes the most productive thing we can do is forget about work. Sometimes it's take a daydreaming walk. Daydreaming is a great example. Here's a mental process that we've long looked down upon. It's one of the first lessons we teach our kids in second grade is stop daydreaming, look at the blackboard, pay attention. Well, it turns out that daydreaming is an incredibly productive mental state. Your mind is mashing together ideas in new ways. It's exploring counterfactuals. And that's why people who daydream more score much higher on tests of creativity. So we have to, I think, let ourselves daydream occasionally.
You, in some of the research that you cite, you point out that there are some problem-solving exercises that researchers have been studying that actually show that people with attention deficit disorder seem to come up with more creative solutions, more of these moments of insight. Does that bear out?
I think it does. I think this begins to explain the limitations of our very narrow model of what productive thinking looks like. So these are studies which both look at creative performance in the lab, but also, and I think this is even more interesting, creative achievement in the real world. And what they find is that people with attention deficit disorders are more likely to be eminent creative achievers in the real world. But what's even more interesting is this is true at all points in the spectrum. So even if you're not diagnosed with ADD and you're just a distractible person, so the technical term for this is having load-laden inhibition, these are the type of people who, when the air conditioner turns on, they can't help but look at it. Or when they're at a cocktail party and they hear lots of conversations all around them, they're always eavesdropping and getting distracted by the neighboring conversations. And what scientists have found is that as long as you've got a moderately high IQ score, it's actually a big advantage to be a little distractible. These people are 7 times more likely to be eminent creative achievers. And that's because, in a sense, what distractibility means is you're always encountering new ideas. You're always combining ideas in new ways. And most of those combinations won't be useful, but every once in a while they take you somewhere interesting.
Are we medicating the creativity out of our children then with so many students taking medication for ADD?
Oh, that's a really complicated subject. And you talk to 10 scientists and you'll get 10 different perspectives on it. I think some people think we're overdiagnosing kids. I think some people think these drugs, overprescribed. Some people think they're very, very useful. So that's a really, really complicated subject. I think what we have to do a better job of in the classroom is just realizing that that valorizing focus, focusing on focus, is not always a good idea. That we should encourage kids to productively daydream too. We should teach them how to be more effective daydreamers. We should teach them, we should really encourage all kinds of creative thinking, not just this one very narrow kind of creative thinking, which involves focusing on a tedious problem.
I got this email from Kate. She says, I have the utmost respect for teachers, but here's my experience with elementary, secondary teachers and creativity. Most teachers seem to have the type of personality that likes order and everything tidy. Creativity often seems to scare them. It's messy and not easily controlled. I'd love it if colleges of education would offer a little interdisciplinary education for education majors, where they'd take a few courses in art and design. These areas might help loosen them up a bit and help them embrace new ideas. And you did find that you cited some research that showed that teachers said that they love creative students, they want to foster creativity, but didn't actually like many of the characteristics that came with highly creative students.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And as that email pointed out, this is for good reasons, right? I'm not sure anyone wants a classroom full of little Pablo Picassos running around. We do need to teach our kids how to raise their hand, how to focus, how to follow instructions. That is very important. But creativity at its heart is about not following instructions. It's about not doing things the way they've always been done before. It's about being a little impulsive. It's about sometimes acting without thinking about the consequences. So I think we have to teach our kids how, within the constraints of the classroom, to still exercise those creative muscles. And the research shows, one thing very effective way to do this is with art education. The research very clearly shows, this is the work of Michael Posner, that kids who are exposed to plenty of arts education, they also develop better attentional skills because they get so absorbed in the task, they get so focused on making their drawing or writing their short story, that they actually flex these attentional muscles as well. I think there's also this sense, even among so-called non-cognitive skills, like teaching our kids how to exert better self-control and become grittier, traits that we know are very, very important for long-term success, sometimes even more important than IQ scores, than sheer intelligence, that one way to boost these skills is by letting our kids fall in love with some activities, letting our kids, exposing them to a menu of possibilities, to arts education, to sports, to all sorts of extracurricular things that they may really enjoy, and then letting them find something that speaks to them, that they get very involved in. And then they're putting in lots of work. They're learning how to work hard, but it doesn't even feel like work. So I think that's something that's often lost as we rush towards classrooms that are full of accountability and standardized testing. That can sometimes be a very, very important thing, but we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that we also have to let our kids fall in love with activities too.
I'm talking with Jonah Lehrer. He is the author of Imagine, How Creativity Works. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment, and you're welcome to join the conversation as well. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And also, in a few minutes, I'll be talking to two teachers who are doing their best to help foster creativity among Iowa's students. They're on their way to Destination Imagination's Global Finals right now. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we're talking about creativity. My guest right now is Jonah Lehrer. He is the author of Imagine, How Creativity Works. And just before the break, we were talking about education and how we want our children to be creative, but at the same time, teachers want orderly classrooms, and sometimes we're at odds with ourselves about what we want. But when you ask teachers if they want to foster creativity among their students, and then in reality, they are not working to do that, do we have a problem with the definition of creativity, Jonah?
Oh, I just think we have to realize that creativity, the creative process, encompasses many different kinds of thinking. And that's why it's so important to teach our kids, to fully use all the different tools that are inside their head. As I said before, I think right now the classroom is set up to encourage one very particular kind of thinking. And that's great, but that can also hold us back in many different ways. When you talk to educators and you talk about the drop-off in creativity, they often refer to the fourth grade slump, that it's in third, fourth, and fifth grade where kids start to become less interested in making new things, in painting those paintings and drawing those drawings and so on. And in part, this is just a consequence of brain development. It's also about this age that the frontal lobes really start to develop, and this allows kids to raise their hands. It allows kids to not eat all the ice cream on their plate. It allows kids to think before acting, you know, develop impulse control. These, of course, are essential traits, but one interesting side effect of the development of impulse control is it can also make the creative process less compelling and, you know, less automatic. That is, Picasso once put it, every child is born an artist, the problems begin when we grow up. That's actually got some neurological truth to it. So I think it's about in fourth grade where kids start to say, you know, I like to draw, but my drawings aren't as good as I want them to be. Or I love writing short stories, but other people don't like them. They don't live up to my standards. So we become more aware that we're making mistakes or the potential of mistakes. We become too attuned to the expectations of others. So I think it's so important. I think the very first thing we should do is really focus on this crucial transition, third, fourth, and fifth grade, and just remind kids, you know, you may not like your drawing now, but if you put in some more work, if you invest in your talent, you can get better at it. So, I think that's the very first thing we should do is just really focus on this crucial transition where kids, you know, where we see about 50% of kids all of a sudden lose interest in the creative act.
Of course, if schools are a little too single-minded in their goals, then many workplaces also are very single-minded in the goal of doing whatever it is that we get paid to do. You profile a couple of very creative workplaces, places that really foster imagination among their employees, and one of those workplaces is 3M in Minnesota. Why did you choose 3M?
I chose 3M. It may not be the sexiest company in the world. You know, I think a lot of people associate 3M with scotch tape and Post-it notes. And yet, in the recent decades, 3M has gone on to pioneer new products and fed every sector. They now have 55,000 products and 55,000 employees, almost a one-to-one employee product ratio. Really, they've got this very impressive track record of innovation. And I was interested in which aspects of their culture have allowed this track record to exist. And sure enough, they've pioneered a lot of very, very interesting techniques, which, you know, ironically, people now associate with places like Google and Facebook and Apple, but they're all really developed at 3M. And this is stuff like the 15% rule, where 3M gives every researcher 15% of their day, they call it the bootlegging hour, to work on side projects, to work on whatever they want. The only requirement is that you tell your colleagues about it. And this has directly led to some real breakthroughs like ScotchGuard, stain-resistant spray you can apply to fabrics and so on. But I think the real benefit of the 15% rule is that it sends this message to employees, what 3Mers call attentional freedom. It reminds them that the company isn't trying to micromanage their mind, that they were hired because they're smart and they're trusted. And so if they need to take a nap, they can take a nap on the napping couches. If they need to walk across the campus, they can do that. That they're in charge of their own attention. And as we said, because sometimes, you know, moments of insight come when you're taking a nap. They come when you're taking that walk. That's a very, very important, I think, message sent to your employees. The other very, I think, important thing 3M does is their forced rotation. So about every 5 years, they shift engineers from field to field. So if you've spent 5 years working on adhesives, they may move you to LCD screens or Pico projectors or nanotechnology, that they want ideas constantly circulating throughout the company. Lots of what they call horizontal interactions. And when you look at where creative ideas come from, they often come from those kinds of transfers, from people making small talk, you know, across seemingly unrelated disciplines and domains. That's often a very, very rich source of insights.
Well, and at 3M, they actually have something that's kind of like a middle school science fair where everybody has to showcase what they're working on, right?
Yes, and that's another way of fostering these kinds of interactions, you know, getting people who seem to have nothing in common. You know, what could a guy working on Post-it notes possibly have to say to someone working on, you know, the glue that holds together the screens in your iPhone or someone working on nanotechnology? And yet those kinds of conversations are often the most important conversations to have.
How about just engineering places for employees to interact spontaneously?
This is a lesson I really learned from Pixar, the animation movie studios. I went there again because they've got this very impressive track record of success. They've produced 12 movies, and all 12 movies have been box office smash hits and critical darlings. So I wanted to understand their secret sauce, in a sense. And the very first thing I discovered was that people kept on talking about the layout of the studios, which were largely done at the behest of Steve Jobs when he was the president of Pixar. And the original plan for the studios called for three separate buildings, one building for the computer scientists, one building for the animators, one building for everyone else. Jobs took one look at these plans and, according to legend, said that is a terrible idea because he realized a successful place like Pixar would depend on getting these different cultures to interact, getting the computer scientists to constantly learn from the animators and so on. And so he insisted everyone share the same space. But he realized that wasn't enough. So he carved out this big lobby, this big atrium in the center of this, you know, it's essentially an old Del Monte canning factory. So it's a vast, vast warehouse. And he started putting everything important in the lobby. He put the mailboxes there and the gift store there and the coffee shop there and the cafe there. But he realized even that's not enough because you could build people a gleaming cafeteria, but the animators would still have lunch with the animators and so on. So then in one of his moments of insight, he insisted there be only two bathrooms in the entire Pixar Studios, and he put those in the lobby as well. Because there's one place we all have to go every day, it's the bathroom. And at first, people thought this was so inconvenient. It was such a waste of time having to go all the way to the lobby every time you needed to go to the restroom. But now when you go to Pixar, you hear again and again these stories of these bathroom breakthroughs that really interesting conversation someone had while washing their hands or that serendipitous chat on the way to the bathroom. That, as Jobs once put it, creativity is just connecting things, and most of those connections come from other people, which is why it's so important to have workspaces that, in a sense, force us to interact, force us to mix and mingle.
I'm talking with Jonah Lehrer. He's the author of Imagine How Creativity Works, and you're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Hal is on the line from Cedar Rapids. Hi, Hal.
Hi, Jonah. I've enjoyed your books, especially the first one you had. Proust was a neuroscientist, and I even read something by Eric Kandel because of you. Anyway,
thank you very much. Very kind of you.
My question is, there's a wonderful short essay by Cynthia Ozick called The Din in the Head, and she writes, it's an unmistakable noise as clearly mine as fingerprint or a twist of DNA. And my question is about the individuality of creativity. And it seems to me, as an old guy, in fact, I'm going for my 50th reunion out at Oberlin College this week, that as you get older, creativity should increase because our individuality increases, our experiences increase, and even the skeptical thought, although I'm not religious, is that God, who is immortal, should be the most creative dude in the whole universe because he just, you know, goes on and on. What do you think about all that?
It's a fascinating question. I think, in particular, the question of the relationship between age and creativity. Because at first glance, the news doesn't appear to be good. I think even though you may have this intuition, I think I shared your intuition that creativity should increase and accelerate as we get older because we've got more experience, more things in our head to connect. The research suggests that the opposite occurs. That this is largely the work of Dean Simonton at UC Davis. He's shown that in various fields, you see different peak ages of creativity. So if you're a poet or a physicist, your peak age of creativity may arrive in your early 30s. If you're a biologist, it may come in your late 30s. If you're a novelist, your mid-40s. Historians, I believe, are the last ones to peak, and they're in their early 50s. But these curves of peak ages of creativity, they tend to be a little depressing because you see this early peak followed by a long, slow decline. And in general, these peak ages tend to come before people get tenure, that they tend to come before we actually have the power to implement our ideas. Now, for a long time, people assumed that there was something inevitable about the drop-off in creativity as we got older, that the imagination, a bit like long-term memory, simply fell apart over time. But that's no longer the case. Instead, people believe that the drop-off in creativity over time is really a byproduct of what they call enculturation. That in a sense, one of the unintended consequences of all that extra experience is we become invested in the status quo. We develop assumptions about how the world works, about how to problem solve, routines and habits. Many of these things make our lives much easier and more convenient, but they can also make it harder to think outside the box. And so that's why if you talk to Simonton, he'll point to people like Bob Dylan, like Pablo Picasso, like the mathematician Paul Erdős, people who managed to stay creative throughout their entire career. This is often because they constantly risk reinvention. They were willing to write a new kind of song, paint a new kind of painting, tackle new kinds of math problems. Because they constantly turned themselves back into beginners, that is what allowed them to escape the usual trap, the usual decline of creativity over time. That then gets back to your question about what the relationship is between increasing experience and expertise and creativity, because, you know, it seems to often be an inverse relationship. And that was quite surprising to me. But there is nothing inevitable about this. And that's the good news, that we can escape it as long as we, you know, I think are brave enough to become outsiders, brave enough to turn ourselves back into beginners.
Thanks so much for your call, Hal. And you mentioned turning ourselves back into beginners. In your book, you write about a phenomenon that you can point out many specific instances of, that people seem to be able to innovate in fields that are not their own, sometimes more effectively than people who devote their whole careers to a field.
Yeah, and this gets back, I think, to the curse of expertise that you know, although we live in a day and age which assumes, you know, if you got a hard problem, you should give it to the guy who knows the most, that can often be a mistake, simply because knowledge comes with blind spots. You know, one of my favorite ways to demonstrate this is by talking about a website called Innocentive.com, I-N-N-O-Centive, C-N-T-I-V-E.com. And this is a crowdsourcing website used by lots of big Fortune 100 companies like General Electric, Procter & Gamble, Eli Lilly, and so on, Kraft Foods. And what they do is they post their hardest scientific problems online, so the problems that their own scientists often can't solve. And they post them online and they say, if you can solve this, here's a monetary reward. So maybe it's $10,000, maybe it's $1 million. It depends on how valuable the solution is to these companies. Now, I think to the shock of everyone, about 40% of these very difficult problems posted on this website get solved. Many of them get solved within a week of being posted online. And this is quite surprising simply because these are problems that these companies with billion-dollar R&D budgets can't solve, and yet they're often solved by strangers working in their pajamas on their couch in their spare time. It is quite surprising. Now, when you look at what allows these problems to be solved by these strangers all across the world, it's really a testament to outsider creativity that, let's say, General Electric posts a chemistry problem on Innocentive. Turns out that chemistry problem is almost never solved by another chemist. Instead, it's often solved by a molecular biologist or a biophysicist or a biologist, someone who knows enough to understand the terms of the question, but doesn't know so much they run into the exact same stumbling blocks as those chemists back at GE. So this shows us that we often see more when we know a little bit less. And I think this really should change the way we assign problems to people, that we should make our teams more intellectually diverse. We should really try to take better advantage of outsider thinking and outsider creativity.
Rick is on the line from Iowa City. Hi, Rick. What's your question?
Morning. I have 2 points, I guess. One is, does creativity depend upon producing an end product? And if so, does that end product and thus creativity have to be validated and accepted by either other people, or can it be created by being accepted just by a monk on a hillside or someone sitting on the front porch?
So does creativity have to have an end product, Jonah?
You know, it's a really interesting question, and this is actually a point that's widely debated among researchers at the moment. Some people think, you know, you can point to people like Vincent van Gogh, who was not appreciated in his own lifetime. So if you define creativity in terms of recognition, in terms of other people validating your end product, whether it's a painting or a patent, whatever it is, then I think we may end up excluding people who, for whatever reason, aren't fully appreciated, you know, in our own day and age. My own personal favorite definition of creativity, and it's something I really wrestled with while writing the book, is simply it's a new idea that has a second life. And by second life, it can be beautiful, it can be useful, someone may just appreciate it, but it's an idea that finds a niche in the world. And I think that allows us to, you know, it allows us a little wiggle room in terms of finding a way to still say that someone like Vincent van Gogh is creative, simply because you don't want to define our ideas too much in terms of the fads and fashions of the present moment, But I think it's also important to distinguish between the fact that we are always generating new ideas, that the human mind is a connection machine. And so I think there is an important test about some of these new ideas are going to be useful and some are going to be forgotten about right away. And I think when we're talking about creativity, we really want to focus on those ideas that are useful. Because let's not forget, you know, when we fall asleep every night, the human mind is just inventing new associations. It's telling us new stories for several hours every night. So that's in a sense a creative act. But I think when most people talk about creativity, they really want to talk about useful creativity. They really want to talk about new ideas that have the second life.
Did all of this research change the way that you work?
It did. One way it changed my process is it did make me better at wasting time. You know, I used to have this puritanical notion that when I was stuck in the writing process, when I didn't know how to begin a sentence or end a paragraph, that what I needed to do was to drink more coffee and stay up late, just power through. And, of course, you wake up the next day and you realize your fixes didn't fix anything and now you're exhausted. And so now when I'm stuck, I'm much more willing to take a hike, to go for a walk. That's my preferred form of relaxation. And I'm sure to leave my smartphone behind so I can, you know, just let my mind wander without constantly interrupting it by checking my email. So that's one way it changed my process. The other big way it changed my process is the second half of the book is really about how we create together and why creative collaborations are becoming more important. So what's the ideal way to work together as a team? How our social networks influence our creativity? You know, why cities are such engines of innovation in the 21st century and so on. And there's an interesting study I described.
We are out of time, unfortunately, Jonah, but thank you so much for your time today. Jonah Lehrer is the author of Imagine How Creativity Works. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking about creativity, and now we're turning to the idea of fostering creativity among our students, and one of the organizations that is working very hard to do that is called Destination Imagination. It's a global nonprofit organization that gives kids an opportunity to experience creativity, teamwork, and problem solving. Every year, tournaments are held that give kids hands-on experience at solving problems and competing with one another. Right now, 13 teams from Iowa are on their way to the global finals of Destination Imagination in Knoxville, Tennessee. And Brett Menard is a Destination Imagination team manager and appraiser. Hello, Brett.
How are you doing today?
Good. Thank you so much for being here. And can you describe Destination Imagination a little bit for us? What kinds of competitions do kids engage in?
Okay, Destination Imagination is a creative problem-solving competition, and it has two parts. The first part is a long-term challenge, and the kids have between 2 and 4 months to work on that. And there's 5 different challenges they can do. There's a technical challenge, a scientific challenge, a fine arts challenge, an improv theater challenge, and a structure building challenge. The students come up with everything they use. If there's any props, they have to create them. They write all the scripts. It's all student driven. And then once they get to the competition site, there's also an instant challenge. An instant challenge is a challenge they have never seen before, and they have about 5 minutes to figure out how to do. And with instant challenges, we have building challenges, we have theater challenges, and we have hybrid challenges where students will have to build something and then incorporate it into a skit.
You coach 3 different teams, right?
Yes, this year I had 3 teams that competed.
And can you give me an example of one of the challenges that your students worked on for those long months?
Okay. One of the challenges my kids did was a coming attractions challenge. It was a fine arts challenge. They had to create a movie trailer style skit that lasted 4 minutes involving people from 2 different nations interacting. And this skit had to have an original soundtrack and it had to have a cinematic special effect. And then they had to perform it live.
And they spent, again, how long working on this?
They spent about 3 months working on it.
And when they, you mentioned the different categories they can compete in, did they work together as a team to choose which category they wanted to be in?
Yes. When I get my groups together, I'm a talented and gifted instructor. So I say, hey, it's time for DI. Here are the five challenges that are available this year. Who wants to do what? And students are teamed together based on what challenge they want to participate in.
And once they have their challenge and they need to start working on their solution to that challenge, what do you do to help create an environment where the team can be creative and collaborate?
A lot of what I do is knowing when to stay out of the way. There's a lot of time where if someone were just to walk into the room, they'd see students thumbing through a book on mythological creatures, and they'd say, oh, they aren't doing anything. But what they're doing is they're gathering information, and they're learning what they need to have to solve their solution. I also try and make sure that there aren't a lot of pressing needs that they have to attend to. I make sure that they know that it's a safe place, that everybody's ideas will be heard out, and your idea might not be the one chosen, but everyone will get a chance to share what they have to say.
And do you give them a lot of guidance as they're coming up with ideas? Are you allowed to participate in that, or is that something where you just have to totally stay out of the way?
I have to totally stay out of the way. The fundamental rule of Destination Imagination is that it's all student-created. Sometimes that's incredibly rewarding. Sometimes that's incredibly frustrating when I'll see what I think to be a good solution, and I have to keep my mouth shut because it's their solution, it's not mine.
What grade levels do you work with your three teams?
I work with junior high students, so 6th, 7th, and 8th.
And can you also give us an example of the kind of instant challenges that these students would be faced with at a tournament?
Okay, so an example of a performance instant challenge would be your team is part of the tourism board for a fake country. Come up with a 3-minute infomercial where you describe the scenery, the attractions, and the climate. An example of a build challenge would be your team has to create a tower that will support the most amount of weight. You are given 4 sheets of paper, 3 mailing labels, 2 tongue depressors, and 1 piece of canvas. And then depending on how much weight it will hold, you get different points based on that. A hybrid challenge would be something like a challenge we did a few years ago called Candyland, where students had to make everyday objects out of candy and then do an infomercial trying to sell them to the appraisers.
Now, you've also served as a judge at some of these tournaments. How do you decide when there are so many different solutions to an instant challenge? How do you decide how to judge them?
When you're appraising an instant challenge, you have subjective and objective scores. So either the structure stood on its own or it didn't. That's a really easy call to make. When you're trying to judge how creative a solution is, then it becomes a bit more challenging. One of the things that we do is we show up on site at the tournament about 2 hours before the kids get there. So we will run through these challenges and we'll say, well, what stood out to us? What are the obvious solutions that we came up with? And we'll generally classify those as pretty common solutions. After that, it's all about being internally consistent. So all I'm worried about when I'm judging is, did I give something the same score if I saw it at the beginning of the day and at the end of the day? Because you have 3 appraisers working with you, minimum, so your scores get averaged.
I'm going to bring Jay Swords into the conversation now. He is on his way to the global finals of Destination Imagination. Hi, Jay.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thank you for taking a little break and talking with us. How many students are you traveling with?
Actually, I'm traveling down with adults. We're, my job as the affiliate director for Global Finals is to be the liaison between the 90 to 100 students from Iowa who are going to be at the tournament and the tournament site. So I make sure that everybody gets to their hotel rooms, that everybody's meal tickets are set up, that everybody's tickets for opening and closing ceremonies are good. And then by far the most fun thing I do is I get to go actually watch the kids perform and cheer them on. And that's really the only time I get to see them doing their performances, so that's really exciting.
And the global finals, how many students from all over the world will be there?
There'll be about 20,000 by the time you've got everybody there from second grade through university students. We represent basically all continental U.S., and we have about 20 countries as well that will be there.
Jay, Brett has walked us through some of the nuts and bolts of the tournaments and how the students compete with one another. What is the overall goal? What's the mission of Destination Imagination?
Our job is to teach creative problem solving and to give students an opportunity to apply their creative problem solving skills in a practical way. So what we're looking for is to give kids an opportunity to actually go through the process and learn the process and then have to actually do it. So much of what we do in school, unfortunately, is abstract or conceptual. You learn a mathematical problem and then you move on to the next mathematical problem. What we want to do is take that a step further, learn a skill, and then actually have to apply it in a competitive situation.
Destination Imagination grew out of Odyssey of the Mind. Odyssey of the Mind continues, and in fact, the world final is coming up for that this coming week as well at Iowa State University, with 17,000 kids and adults coming together to solve problems in a very similar way. Can you tell us what makes these organizations different?
The easiest way to answer that, OM is more formulaic than DI. They basically have the same mission, and I'm certainly not going to say anything bad about OM because I was in OM for years. I like the organization, but the fundamental difference, DI really operates on the idea that anything is possible. I'm going to give you a structure and then let you run with it. OM is much more like a traditional school program in that you get a very narrow set of parameters, and then you have to conform to those parameters.
How did you get involved with Destination Imagination, Jay?
Well, I came out of an OM background, and essentially what happened is about 12 years ago, OM had an internal dispute that locked up the organization. There were competing litigating parties, and there wasn't going to be a problem-solving opportunity for a year, for a school year. And I and a number of other people involved in OM said, we're not going to allow that to happen. So we got together and basically created a set of problems and formed Destination Imagination. Well, eventually OM got its collective house together. There was a split, and DI then became one part of that. And then OM has continued on as its own separate entity. I'm just glad, I don't want to bash OM. I love OM, and the more creative problem solving we have, the better from my point of view.
What is it about this kind of problem solving activity that made you say, I'm not going to go a year without offering this kind of opportunity for students?
Well, two answers for that. I think the first one is, creative problem solving is something that is just absolutely lacking for most kids' educational upbringing. Schools don't do it. We don't create those kinds of things. It's not part of general curriculum. And yet, in adult life, it's what we do all the time. You know, from the shortest thing of, I can't get my car started and I have to go to work in 2 hours. How am I going to get there? All the way up to jobs like Alicia's, who's with me, who that's what she does, is build software programs and design ways to use cutting-edge technology where there isn't anything other than, I have an idea, how do I make that idea real? So that's part of it. The other thing, from a purely personal point of view, is if you have watched these kids work, it is such an absolutely exciting process. What they do, what they're capable of doing, is mind-boggling. And I use that word very, very directly. I mean, you just can't comprehend some of the stuff that they come up with. A few years ago, we had a kid from Iowa, from Fairfield, Iowa, build his own computer from scratch. I don't mean he got the parts and put it together. I mean, he actually made circuitry in order to build this computer so that it would solve a particular problem in a skit that he was doing. That's for a technological moron like myself. That's mind-boggling. And this kid was 16. You know, and so when you see that kind of thing going on, how can you not want that to continue?
Now, often it is students in talented and gifted programs who participate in Destination Imagination, who participate in Odyssey of the Mind. Clearly, it's not just students in talented and gifted programs that are able to think creatively and come up with amazing solutions to problems. So, Jay, I have a feeling you have some pretty strong feelings about how do you think this kind of problem-solving technique could be implemented in regular classrooms?
Oh, I think and not only can it be done, but it is being done. Most of the reason that tag kids are involved is because from a school institution point of view, it's where the funds are. The money tends to come out of the gifted and talented programming, and so gifted and talented kids do it. But I do instant challenge stuff with at-risk populations a lot. I do DI kinds of activities. They don't compete, but I do DI activities with special ed populations. I do a lot of DI activities with vocational ed programs because, as Brett talked about, you know, you've got a structural engineering problem. You've got a mechanical and electrical engineering problem. So there's a lot of those kinds of things. Those opportunities are there. The hard part is really getting administrators and the people who have purse strings to let you do this because it doesn't fit neatly within a curriculum. You know, even a welding class is busy teaching you, well, how do I make this kind of a weld? I want them to go a little further and say, okay, how do I build a tower, or how do I make a car that's going to be able to move X amount of weight or whatever. That takes time, and that's a little tough to do. The other thing that I think gets teachers in trouble is what Brett just talked about, which is you have to let the kids be in control. It's their solution. They have to figure it out. And lots of teachers really struggle with that idea of letting go. Brett talked about it. It's really hard to, you know, when you think you've got the solution and they're going in a different direction, it's hard to just let that happen. And yet, more often than not, their solutions are infinitely better than the ones I come up with.
Well, Jay, thank you so much for talking with us today. He's on his way to the global finals for Destination Imagination right now. Thanks a lot, Jay.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Jay Swartz. And Brett, before I let you go, in the students that you've worked with Destination Imagination, can you give me an example of how you've seen one student really grow from this experience?
I have one student who, for his sake, I will not share his name on the radio, but he was very, very shy. He's a very insular kid. But you put him into a Destination Imagination Challenge, and all of a sudden, he is the most outstanding, out-there actor you've ever met because it's not his personality. He is playing a part, and it allows students to try on different roles, and sometimes they find one that fits, and their personality starts to change, and usually for the better.
Brett, thank you so much. Brett Menard,
you're very welcome.
Brett Menard is Destination Imagination team manager and also an appraiser or judge. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, Bill McAnally, our home improvement expert, will be here. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.